Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the fifth of 11 conversations with former Secretary of State George Shultz and former Stanford University professor and senior fellow Henry Rowan. In this talk, they dig into Shultz's experiences at the State Department and how they worked with other areas of the government, including how recruiting happened within the government. We hope you enjoy this episode and be sure to check back each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
George, I'd like to begin by asking you some questions about the organization of the government for foreign policy and national security. As I understand it, the power has sort of moved around the government from time to time, this sort of central focus. It has been principally in the State Department, the main action at times in the past, and then it's moved more to the White House, National Security Council staff and the White House. And there's a question about if there is one best way or better way. It's not either or, because these actors all have to be involved. But there is a difference between the White House being, if you call it, a coordinator, or seeing that there are gaps, things don't get dropped through the cracks, but not being operational so much, and letting the State Department essentially take the lead, with the Defense Department obviously having to be a major participant in other agencies, intelligence and so on. And one we've seen more recently, I think, where the White House takes really more of a lead and gets operational in many ways. Seems to be there's a big issue here. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I think it's a big issue. And I hear people who are in the NSC staff say, I'm on the NSC. They are not on the NSC. The National Security Council consists, by statute, of the president, the vice president, the secretary of state, and the secretary of defense. That's the National Security Council. The people in the White House are on the staff of the National Security Council. One reason I thought Colin Powell was so good as in that post was he came over to me and he said, George, I am on your staff. And I am a staff member for the Vice President and the Secretary of Defense, but of course my principal client is the President.
Right.
And so he had it right. And I think when the National Security Council staff goes operational, it's not a responsible way to do things. Mm-hmm. And they also can get the President in a lot of trouble. Witness the Iran-Contra mess, which was
indeed
produced by the NSC staff going wild.
Right.
But I think it's obviously the president is the key, and everything revolves around the president. People used to ask me about my foreign policy. I said, I don't have one. The president has one. My job is to help him formulate it and carry it out. But when you want to carry something out, the horses are in the departments. That is, if you want to carry out a military operation, that's what the Pentagon does. And the State Department does diplomacy. And I think the key is to organize it so that these two things are interactive. Because if you have an exercise of strength and you don't have any diplomacy to go with it, it's a wasting asset. If you try diplomacy with no strength, it's a waste of time. You've got to, and the key is always to have these two things interactive. And the NSC staff is a coordinating staff, and their job is to see to it that all the options are there for the president to look at. And that's their task. And when you deviate from that, you drift into trouble, I think.
Why do you think some presidents have deviated from that? Is it because they just had a different management theory, or because they didn't really adequately think about or informed about these alternatives, or any notion about it?
Well, people have personalities somehow get in the way. I was always amazed as a person in President Nixon's cabinet, first as Secretary of Labor, so I was a ways away from all this. But then I was asked to chair a cabinet task force on the oil import control system. And all of a sudden, Henry Kissinger's light went on, that there are things like that that are sort of economics-y, but they have strategic implications. Mm. So he took an interest. But Here was Bill Rogers, Secretary of State, who was a great friend of the president's. And when Bill was the Attorney General, he was very helpful politically to the president. And yet, so he was Secretary of State, and somehow big, important things got done, and he was not in the loop. And it just didn't seem like the right thing to do, although certain things did work. The China policy worked because of the talents involved, but I think it's not a good way to
organize things. Yeah, it's never struck me as a good way to do things. Is part of it, you mentioned the energy issues back then, 30 years ago. Did the State Department have the expertise? Did it have people who could bring much to the topic? Was that part of it?
Well, I don't know about that, but I would say, in my experience with the State Department, you had people, for instance, Stapleton Roy, mm-hmm. the Foreign Service officer. Mm-hmm. And I always thought he was really good mm-hmm. and well-informed, tough-minded guy. And he was outstanding later on as ambassador to mm-hmm. China. Mm-hmm. So there are people, but if there aren't people, they should be developed. And one of the problems, the State Department has a personnel system that strikes me as not as good as it could be, I'll put it that way. In the first place, you want to go after, as the people you're bringing in, you want to go after these young people getting out of college these days. They're so good. And bring them in, and if you don't do it, if you wait, as they tend to do in the Foreign Service until they're out 3 or 4 years, they're lost to investment banking or something. But you can get them early on, and then they work hard effectively. They do get good people, and they get a variety of experiences. And they get into their early 50s, they're ambassador somewhere, and then they're out. It's ridiculous. If you're running a company, I've had the privilege of being involved at a top level in a company and seen some others as a director, which are well run. And in a well run company, you do this, you develop people and they get into their early 50s, and you say, now is the time we're really going to get mileage out of this person. This person is now equipped to be a real leader. That's the most productive time. And in the government, that's when they are let go, and they come into companies and they do terrific work. So we ought to have some way of holding them, because the United States, almost unlike any other country, has to conduct a global diplomacy. We're involved everywhere, and you can't just say it's only this or it's only that. You've got to be able to operate on a global basis, and that means you have to have a lot of big people who can go into a head of state's office and be recognized, not just because they're representing the U.S., but because it's obvious this is a person who's got high caliber. You don't have to explain it twice. And when that person goes home, he or she is going to have an audience right at the top. So you need these kinds of things. We're not organized right now.
I remember Dick Walters. I used to see him at various airports around the world.
Yeah, well, he was a great guy.
A great linguist, very savvy, very knowledgeable. Everybody knew him.
Everybody knew him, and he could go anywhere and speak the local language.
Right.
So he could have real conversations with people.
Yeah, right.
And we had in the Reagan administration, as you know, we made a big effort to see that the Pope was continuously, completely informed on what we were thinking and what we were doing. And whenever a person like me went, we always went and called on the Pope. He received me. But then Dick Walters was a friend. He spoke Polish and Italian or whatever it was.
Right.
And so you need people who can do that.
Right. No, that's very, very clear. Let me ask a different, it's related question. It's about the intelligence system. It's certainly an essential for any conduct of foreign policy. We have obviously serious problems. We had some really major failures in recent years. We've had failures from time to time, everybody does. But But we've had some big ones lately. 9/11, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq not being there, after the intelligence community said they were there. We've reorganized it. It's not clear that it's really been fixed. And it's a very difficult relationship, always. You've had a lot of interaction. By the way, one of the interesting things about the weapons of mass destruction fiasco was that the good, relatively good performer, I wouldn't say super good, but relatively good performer in that was the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. They weren't buying this nuclear weapon in Iraq all that much. So that's one sort of observation. But any thoughts you have on that relationship and that very important function, I'd like to hear.
Well, obviously, it's like anything else. The key is having terrific people who are creative and who are smart and have an independent-minded streak in them. And so you want to organize things also, I think, where you have competitive analysis that goes on and really work at that, where you examine your sources very carefully to be sure that they're genuinely independent. You have to have multiple sources to have anything you can rely on. And I assume that they're pushing on that, but too easily people get fooled. I think it's very important that the intelligence people not have policy views, because that tends to distort their intelligence. I was always impressed in the Nixon administration when I was occasionally invited to an NSC meeting that it would start with Dick Helms, who was then the director of the CIA, a terrific guy, and he would give a briefing and he would answer questions. And when all the questions were exhausted, he would get up and leave the room. He didn't feel that weighing in on the policy issues was the appropriate thing for him to do. But then later, Bill Casey was head of the CIA, a person that I knew well and had worked with earlier. But Bill had a big agenda. And so even where, if you disagreed with him, you were worried about what he was telling you. But even when you agreed with him, you wanted, well, is this really objective? And so, as a user of the intelligence, I devised my own things to do. There was the State Department group that were good people. But then when there was something that I really wanted to dig into, I'd ask the director to come over to my office, and I'd always say, bring some of your analysts along. And you get three or four of the analysts and maybe one or two people from the State Department. And I try to provoke a conversation, not trying to get any, just let's talk about it. And then you'd get a sense of the nuances and the differences and so forth, rather than some unified opinion. Because in the end, it's not for the intelligence people to tell you what to think. It's for you to make up your own mind what you think, based on all the information you can gather.
I take it, yeah, that you've done some.
For instance, when it came to analyzing the Soviet Union, obviously that was their biggest mission, and they got a lot of it wrong.
Sure did.
But I thought, just as an example, the dispatches that would come from Bill Keller, who was in Moscow for the New York Times, they were really terrific dispatches. I read them very carefully. So you, as a policymaker, you reach out all the different places and see what you think. The CIA put out an analysis of Gorbachev, which was sort of like nothing much. And I said to them once, I've logged more time talking to him than anybody else in the government. You never asked me for my opinion. And it's different from yours. Maybe that's why they didn't ask.
Yeah, that's a good point. Journalists actually do have better access, on the whole, than intelligence people.
Well, it's not necessarily better access. It's different access.
Well, it's different, but actually they can talk to them in ways frequently that the others can't.
They're not biased in favor of things that are collected secretly.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's one of the the problems, that you think something you got from some source who may be questionable is more important than what is right there for the taking. Yeah. And I was very glad to see, and I think, as I remember, the commission that you were a member of recommended this, but the CIA has opened an office or something, unit, that's going to make it its job to look at open sources, particularly in this day and age with so much information available. You can find out most of what you want to know by open source.
You can get an awful lot, and I found it remarkable on this commission that we had to make that recommendation.
Yeah.
But in any case, we did have to, and I guess they're doing something about it.
But they also are, you dig in and you find a lot of talented people there, and they have been good. I'll give an example of something they did that was just terrific. When I was Secretary of the Treasury, President Nixon was pursuing his detente policy with the Soviet Union, and he opened up our grain markets to them to purchase grain. Of course, our farmers like that. And the Soviets, who weren't supposed to know anything about markets, you know, they're just communists, what do they know? Well, they were very clever. They were going to make huge amounts of buying. And they knew that, but the market didn't know that. So they bought a little bit over here, and they bought a little bit over there, and a little bit over here. Before you know it, they had cornered the market, and prices skyrocketed, so I said, that's never going to happen again. And I had long talks with a man named Kosygin, who was their second in command in the Soviet Union, a smart guy, about how to restructure things, and the long-term grain agreement emerged from that. But in the meantime, I said, we have to know more about what's happening to their crops. And I knew a little bit about their capabilities from my time as the budget director, so I went to the president about it. And so I got a certain priority, and I said to them, we want to know more about the Soviet crop prospects. And obviously, during the course of a growing season, it changes, because you don't know what the weather's going to be and so on. So we need successive readings as best you can put it together. And they used their satellite technology and other things. And they did an absolutely brilliant job. And we knew more about the Soviet crops than the Soviets
did. I'm sure that was true.
And so it helped us a lot in trying to manage this thing. And keep the market operating right. So that I was very impressed with their ability. But also I think that shows the policymaker needs to ask questions, to say to the intel, this is what we're interested in, this is why we're interested in it. And so they can respond to that. Sometimes it's as though nobody asks them a question and they just sort of think up and give you stuff which you may want or you may not want. So I think this question of how the interaction should be between the people who are going to use the intelligence and the people who are going to provide it is a very important thing to get right.
If you grow up in the system, you can learn that. If you come from outside, the president comes from outside, typically.
And most of the cabinet members come.
Most of the cabinet members. You know,
and sometimes the director of Central Intelligence comes from outside.
And so, you know, you think they really need a course. And that's, I guess, the period from the election to inauguration is a period for them to learn that sort of thing. But some of them don't seem to quite get it. It's a problem.
It's a problem. But it's got clear, I think it's got pretty clear answers. And you've got people from the outside who are outstanding. Well, I can understand John McCone, for instance, was a superb director.
Excellent.
Of Central Intelligence.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Indeed. I'd like to switch to it's another organizational question. You directed the Office of Management and Budget some years before that. I worked there for a couple of years when it was the Bureau of the Budget, a very elite organization, very excellent people. I thought it had the best staff.
Terrific.
Any place.
They regarded themselves as the president's bureaucracy. Right. They were very oriented to the presidency. Whoever was president, the presidency was their client.
In a good position to see a lot. See, everything really, anything they wanted to, they could really get into, because they had the power of the purse, in a way,
right,
enabled them to get into things. Is it an under, your impression, you've been out of it for a long time, but is it an underutilized organization? I have the impression that it is, that it's not being used as much as it might be on a variety of fronts. You mentioned before we got started here on some organizational plan that you had for on a bunch of domestic issues. Could you say something about that?
Well, the OMB is at the center. They're the president's bureaucracy, and they try to exercise on behalf of the presidency all of the clout that being in that central place gives them, but very responsibly for the president. And of course, one of the issues for the president is always how do you organize the federal government so it's effective? And President Nixon was very interested in that. And he put together a commission that a man named Roy Ash headed. And they made some recommendations. And it became up to the then Office of Management and Budget, which I was the first director. It was the Budget Bureau with a management task added to it, to develop these ideas and try to get them implemented. So I studied that a lot, and we did make proposals, but they sort of went down the drain with the Watergate problems. Mm-hmm. But the basic ideas were good ideas, and I think still are there to be implemented. And fundamentally, the idea was to think of the government as being organized with certain categories of work. You have national security and foreign policy. You have economics and finance. You have natural resources. You have human resources. You have law enforcement. And so you have these groupings. And the idea was to organize the cabinet and associated groups into these things and to get one of the cabinet members to be the lead person. Mm. And to then have the president interact that way. Mm-hmm. I remember at the time we counted up that there was something like 150 people who were supposed to report directly to the president. So you know that's ridiculous. Yeah,
it probably hasn't gone down any in the years
since. What happens is people think something or other is important, and they say, okay, this person's got to report directly right to the president.
Yeah.
So President Nixon could see that that wasn't effective. So he tried to get these interests organized together. Mm. And in that way, he'd have fewer people reporting directly, and the whole thing could be more effective. I think it was a really good idea. And actually, he implemented it in the economic sphere. Mm. Because when I was director of the budget, my office was in the West Wing of the White House. I had a suite, and he wanted it to be clear to everybody that it was his budget. So his budget director was in the White House. And then when I became Secretary of the Treasury, he basically said, keep your office and be an assistant to the president for economic policy and be the coordinator for the president at the same time Secretary of the Treasury. And I think the Treasury, it's sort of like what we were saying in the national security area. The Treasury has the horses when it comes to anything to do with finance, collection of money, and so on, tax bills. That's where the ability to really analyze it and put forward in detail any kind of thing like that. So the Treasury is a natural coordinating point for the president. And it was an effort to implement this idea insofar as the economics was concerned.
That has,
and it worked pretty well.
And something like that idea has continued on the economic front.
Right, and when Robert Rubin was Secretary of the Treasury, he managed to get it very much as I did, but not with the formality of it. He had been a coordinator in the White House.
Right.
And he remained the only cabinet member, as I understand it, who attended every morning the regular White House meetings.
Uh-huh.
So he maintained himself as part of the White House.
Right.
And the person that was his assistant when he was directing things became the director or to put it another way, still his assistant. And so he was the key figure on behalf of the president.
But that's not happened.
And I think that's a good way to do it.
It hasn't happened in the other areas. But.
It hasn't happened in the other areas, and I think we've drifted away from it in the economic area, too.
I see. Yeah, right. Say a little bit about the Treasury function. You know, most governments have the budget function in the Ministry of Finance, along with all of the others. It was in 1922, I think it was, we split it out, set up a separate Bureau of the Budget. It was a long time ago.
Yeah, well, I think it was when Roosevelt was president.
Was it that recently? Was it then? Okay, it was a long time ago.
As the war came upon.
And
anyway, in that period.
That had to reduce the authority, the power of the Secretary of the Treasury, not having that function. Well, did you notice? I mean, you were in both positions, so.
To some degree, but back then there was what was called the Troika. The Secretary of the Treasury, the Director of the Budget, and the Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers. And that trilogy sort of managed things on behalf of the President, and the Secretary of the Treasury was the leader of it. So, but the Treasury was the first department of the federal government that was created before any other. And in the protocol of things, now the State Department is thought of as the first department, so to speak, and the Treasury steps back to be number two. But everybody knows if you've got the money, you're an important position. Yeah, so most of the domestic side of the federal government is a spin out from the Treasury. And the budget, for instance, the Secretary of the Treasury long since realized, if I'm going to raise the money and finance something, I've got to know what it is that I have to finance. And so the Treasury created a budget. And there was, in effect, a kind of budget bureau in the Treasury, and that was transferred and became the Bureau of the Budget.
Right. So what about the Treasury Department? And again, thinking of this from an organizational standpoint, is it set up right? I mean, you've mentioned this Troika function and the need for coordination, but what about internally? Is it got the right set of responsibilities, organization?
Well, it's been peeled down now to where it's the economic agency with basically revenue-raising responsibilities. Mm-hmm. So it has a tax group. Of course, it has the Internal Revenue Service. Mm-hmm. A lot of what the Treasury does has been spun out of it.
But international finance is very
international
important.
International finance, and Arthur Burns always used to say that domestically the Fed is an independent agency. When we go abroad, we're the banker for the Treasury. He had a clear distinction about that.
Right.
And when I was Secretary of the Treasury, of course, there was a huge amount of change in the international exchange rate system. Mm-hmm. And what's now, in effect, came into being when I was in office. There was a big struggle over
Bretton
that.
Bretton Woods collapsed.
Yeah, right. It was fun. I mean, you had a lot of action. I don't know, it was fun.
Not for everybody.
It was a good time to be there because there was something to be done. I advocated and still advocate a system of flexible exchange rates, so I was glad to be part of bringing that into effect.
That's clearly what happened, of course, in the years since, except for the euro.
I've read recently a wonderful biography of Alexander Hamilton. And all of the origins of the Treasury are there. And I didn't realize the extent to which the Treasury initially, for its revenues, relied on the collection of customs duties. And it was a struggle between the states, who's going to collect these duties? And this was one of the things that Hamilton did, was to get control of that. And that's how the Coast Guard got created. The Coast Guard was the first armed force, so to speak, and it got created to patrol the borders on the seas and to be sure that we collected the revenue.
Well, if that was still the case today, we'd have a much smaller government. We kept inventing other taxes.
Yeah, but Lyndon Johnson, when he was president, created the Department of Transportation. And I guess he didn't have anything substantive to put into it. So he put the Coast Guard into it. Right. And no Secretary of the Treasury will ever forget it. Deprived us of our boats and our airplanes.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Our nice mess and everything.
Right. And once in a while, I suppose, they get yachts. What's the IRS that gets yachts? Collects them from the IRS. Deadbeat non-taxpayers.
The IRS is a tricky management problem. When I became Secretary of the Treasury, the Commissioner of Internal Revenue came to me and he said, obviously, you're the person we look to for policy, but we think it's probably a good idea if you don't involve yourself in individual cases.
Yeah, yes.
And I thought that over. I said, what about my predecessors? What have they done? And I said, well, it varied. Secretary Connolly wanted to be involved in individual cases or know about them if needed. And I thought about it and I said, no, I don't want individual cases. That's sort of a professional matter and it's better if the politically appointed person is not involved. So I signed something that. So one day Johnny Walters came to me and he said, I have a problem about individual cases. I said, what are you coming to me for, Johnny? I thought you didn't want me to be involved. He said, well, this is different. He said, the president's counsel, then a man called John Dean, came to my office and said, here's a list of names, I don't remember, 50 or so, and I want you to do full field investigations on them.
Oh.
That's a very unpleasant thing if you get that kind of an investigation. And so I'm coming to you with this. And I said, well, obviously you're not going to do it. There's no reason. This is the use of the IRS for harassment of people, and that's not proper. So he said, well, what am I going to tell John Dean when he asked me what's going on? I said, you tell him your report to me. And if he has a problem, he has it with me. And that was the end of it. John Dean never came, although the tapes have showed he and President Nixon complaining about me for this.
Good decision. I think this is the end of our session. Thank you very much. Very interesting points, which are now on the record.